Welcome to Ingest, the podcast series designed for primary care and brought to you by the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. My name's Charlie Andrews, a GP with an extended role in gastroenterology based in Midsummer Norton near Bath. This is an educational podcast where we bring you experts in various fields of gastroenterology to give you reliable and up-to-date advice and education in various topics of gastroenterology. I'm delighted to have Professor Mark Pritchard joining me today to discuss neuroendocrine tumours. Professor Pritchard is Professor of Gastroenterology at the University of Liverpool. He is a clinical lead at the European Neuroendocrine Tumour Society, or ENETS, Centre of Excellence in Liverpool. He's also the current UKNETS, or UK Neuroendocrine Tumour Society, chair, and he has extensive knowledge in diagnosing and managing patients with neuroendocrine tumours. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I'm really excited to talk about neuroendocrine tumours with you. I think the first thing I'm going to ask you is this. There will be listeners out there who are wondering, is this particularly relevant for primary care? I've rarely heard of neuroendocrine tumours. Is this something I really need to know about? How would you answer that question, Mark?
I think you do need to know something about them. And the reason for that is that recently there have been studies both in the UK and in the US that shows that the incidence of these tumours is increasing. And particularly because many patients live a long time, the prevalence is actually quite large. So because many patients live for many years, this is now actually the 10th most prevalent cancer in the UK. And many people, many GPs, many other healthcare professionals haven't heard very much about them. But because people often live for many years, you will probably have a few patients in your practice who do have neuroendocrine tumours. So you would probably, you know, you will all know about the very common cancers, breast, lung, prostate, whatever. But if somebody has a somewhat less common cancer, you would be expecting to know something about it and the management. Because neuroendocrine tumours are quite prevalent, I think you should know something about them. There's also been about a fourfold increase in incidence over the last 20 years or so. Much of that, I think, is increased recognition. So pathologists, endoscopists, radiologists are much more aware these days of the characteristics of this type of tumour than they were 20, 30 years ago. So it's being increasingly recognised. I think it's mostly that rather than a true increase in incidence. But they are being increasingly diagnosed, and you will come across patients who've got these tumours.
Thank you. The 10th commonest tumour, that is quite a lot, isn't it? We do need to be thinking about this.
Yeah.
So should we go back and think about what a neuroendocrine tumour is? Are you able to tell us what a neuroendocrine tumour is and what this actually means?
Yeah, so that's actually a much more difficult question than you might think. So this is a group of tumours that can arise in various anatomical sites that has particular histopathological characteristics. So it's essentially a histopathological diagnosis. The cells have some endocrine features, so some hormonal features, but they arise from the neuroendocrine system, which is a diffuse hormonal signaling system throughout the body. So they can arise in many places. The commonest sites are within the GI tract and pancreas and the lung. And there are different classification systems which include various different tumour types within this whole umbrella. So some classifications will include things like pheochromocytomas, medullary thyroid cancers, things like that within this type of tumour. But in the main, and for the remainder of this podcast, I would suggest we'll limit them to neuroendocrine tumours, mostly in the GI tract, pancreas, lung, what historically used to be called carcinoid tumours, but the modern nomenclature is a neuroendocrine tumour.
Brilliant, thanks. So are there certain patient groups who are more likely to develop these types of cancers or these types of tumours?
Not really. So they occur in both men and women. As with most cancers, they generally are more common in older individuals, although we do often find them in some young people, particularly things like appendix neuroendocrine tumours, which are found when people have their appendicectomy. They're often found in young people because those are the people who are having their appendix removed. They're often not that serious, but they do cause a lot of anxiety to the people involved because they can be, children or young adults. There are a few genetic conditions which mean that you're prone to these tumours. The most famous is probably multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, MEN1, but you're not going to see an awful lot of patients with that in primary care unless you happen to perhaps have a family with them in your practice. But other than that, they can affect anybody, and the vast majority of cases are sporadic. We don't, in the majority of cases, know what causes them. We don't really understand the etiological factors very well.
So we've got the neuroendocrine tumours. You mentioned several locations where they can develop. Where are the commonest places to find these types of tumours?
The commonest places are the small bowel, and within that, it's usually the terminal ileum. The pancreas is another common site, and the lung. So in the lung, for some strange reason, these are still called carcinoid tumours. Everywhere else, we now call them neuroendocrine tumours or neuroendocrine neoplasms, but the nomenclature is still for a lung carcinoid. Those are the three commonest sites, but they can occur in the stomach, duodenum, appendix, colon, rectum, anywhere in the GI tract. And that's why in many places, gastroenterologists are involved in caring for these patients, because the commonest sites are within the GI tract and pancreas.
How do these tumours tend to present? I know that's probably going to open a huge can of worms, but I'm really interested to know, what sort of presentation we might be expecting to find, if any.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem with them. They can present in lots of different ways. So the way most people will have heard of is, going back to your medical school career, you'll have heard of some of these famous hormonal syndromes. So most people remember about carcinoid syndrome, and they'll have heard perhaps of Zollinger-Ellison syndrome from a gastrinoma in the pancreas that's secreting gastrin, or a VIPoma from a tumour secreting VIP in a patient having profuse watery diarrhoea. But those are very rare presentations. Well, I don't know about very rare, but even in a tertiary practice like mine, we see those patients relatively infrequently. And the tumours can present in a number of other ways. They can present because of their anatomical location. So if we think, for example, of a small bowel neuroendocrine tumour, that can cause abdominal pain and features of small bowel obstruction, like any other tumour located at that site. And that would be true for any location. They can cause vague, non-specific symptoms like any other metastatic malignancy. So things, non-specific things like weight loss, fatigue, they can sometimes present in that way. And many cases we find incidentally. So because patients are increasingly having scans or endoscopies, we often find these unexpectedly, or a patient sometimes goes for surgery. Not uncommonly, we have patients who are going for a resection of a pancreatic tumour, thinking that that's a pancreatic adenocarcinoma, and the histology, to everybody's surprise, comes back saying, no, that was a neuroendocrine tumour. So we get lots of cases where this was not necessarily suspected, but comes, is found as the result of a patient having a scan or a endoscopy or surgery, sometimes for another reason.
I've heard of the carcinoid syndrome with the flushing, diarrhea, wheezing. Slightly disappointed now that you said that that's exceptionally rare. I'm sure at med school I was told that we were going to find it in every patient we were looking for.
You'd be lucky if you diagnose one in your whole career as a GP, I would have thought.
Yeah, so we need to keep this on our mind, don't we? We really need to be thinking about it, in that, yeah, as you said, those non-specific symptoms and also those GI symptoms you're talking about, the small bowel symptoms you can get. Can it look like things like irritable bowel syndrome? Could it develop with just diarrhea?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's our main challenge, and the challenge to which we don't really have an answer. So irritable bowel syndrome is obviously extremely common, and you'll see lots of people with it. But there is the occasional patient, and they come to us 10 years down the line when they've been diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome and treated for irritable bowel syndrome for a decade. And then for some reason, it clicks and the actual diagnosis is made, and all along they've had a neuroendocrine tumour. But picking out that needle in the haystack of all the patients that you see with irritable bowel syndrome is very difficult. But it can present in similar ways. You know, people get diarrhoea, particularly if they've got a functional or secretory tumour. Patients will have abdominal pain is a feature. So it's not uncommon for people to be diagnosed as diarrhea predominant IBS. I'm not suggesting that every patient you see with IBS, you should be thinking, have they got a neuroendocrine tumour and should they be having lots of additional tests? IBS is a positive diagnosis that you can make based on specific criteria and a limited number of investigations to rule out things like celiac disease. I still think that that's the right approach. But if a patient has got unusual features, is carrying on for a long time, not settling, there are things that are making you a bit worried. This, as well as other tumours, colon cancer or whatever, are things to be thought about. And maybe in those patients, you need to think about, should they be having some more tests? But don't think about it in everybody at the first presentation.
You don't want to be completely overwhelmed.
Okay, no, as they say, the vast majority of people with IBS have IBS.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the idea here is we're trying to find that needle in the haystack, and we need to be thinking about it and looking at, is this a classic presentation or is there something there that's getting your spidey sense going and making you think about something slightly different within that presentation?
One thing I think is perhaps not fully appreciated is age. So IBS normally starts in younger patients, in young adults. And if you take a good history, even if a patient is presenting at the age of 40 or 50, they probably will have had some suggestion of this earlier on in life, even if they haven't presented to see a GP about it. If they are presenting de novo at the age of 40, 50 or older with symptoms that are typical of IBS, but with nothing beforehand, that I think is something that should make you think, is there something else going on? We don't usually see alarm symptoms like rectal bleeding or anemia or anything like that, but I think age is a factor. Weight loss is another thing that would concern me, because patients with IBS don't usually lose weight. And if they're losing weight, particularly if they're older, those are the sorts of things that might make me think about doing some additional investigations.
You mentioned also about endoscopy and how it's got quite an important role in diagnosing these conditions, because actually sometimes it's being identified when people are being referred for a lower or upper GI endoscopy. We have some endoscopy listeners on the podcast, and it'd be really helpful if you could just give a couple of points about what to look out for and how to approach a situation where you might be suspecting that you're looking at a neuroendocrine tumour.
If you're doing a gastroscopy, these tumours can arise in the stomach, or they can arise in the duodenum. They don't very commonly arise in the esophagus. So in the stomach, they're usually polyps. The type 1 gastric neuroendocrine tumours are the ones associated with pernicious anemia and the commonest type, and they're usually multiple polyps and are easily confused with fundic cystic gland polyps. That's why the BSG recommends that all gastric polyps should be biopsied, because I think it's very difficult to establish the diagnosis without a biopsy. Even if that's, you know, a one-off occasion, you establish that they're fundic cystic gland polyps, at least you've got a diagnosis. But if you see multiple polyps in the stomach, particularly if the stomach is atrophic, you can't see the normal folds in the mucosa, then they need biopsy. Type 3 gastric neuroendocrine tumours, which are less common but more serious, usually arises single polyps. They can be confused with hyperplastic polyps or adenomas or even with a gastric cancer. But I think if you see a single gastric polyp, it should definitely be biopsied. Similarly, the duodenal ones usually present as solitary polyps, usually in the first part of the duodenum, occasionally in the second and sometimes near the ampulla. But again, solitary polyps in the duodenum, I think, should be biopsied. You'll find all sorts of things if you do biopsy them. And those are the things to look out for, polyps in the stomach and the duodenum. If you're doing colonoscopy, the commonest site is the rectum. So if you see rectal polyps that are not typically adenomas or hyperplastic polyps, so with a normal mucosa, normal pit pattern, they may be rectal nets. And what's suggested you do with those is you biopsy them first rather than doing a resection, a polypectomy, because if you do want to go and resect them, you need to do that properly in a planned procedure rather than at the first endoscopy. The other place you will see them if you're doing a full colonoscopy is in the terminal ileum, where you will see submucosal polyps. Don't see them very often, but you will, if you're doing a lot of colonoscopy, you will see them from time to time. And we get patients who are picked up on the bowel cancer screening program, not infrequently, where that's found. And again, try and biopsy them. Don't try and resect them endoscopically, because these are submucosal polyps. You won't be able to resect them endoscopically. They will need surgical removal if that's what you find. So it's basically looking for polyps, as you would in any sort of endoscopy. Look carefully for polyps, and the more polyps you find, some of them will be neuroendocrine tumours.
Great, thanks so much, Mark. That's really helpful advice. I myself do upper GI endoscopy, and so yeah, really useful for me, and I'm sure for our endoscopy performing colleagues. So yeah. Just going back to primary care and the clinicians on the front line. So, you know, they've listened to this podcast and now they're starting to think a bit more about neuroendocrine tumours. What sort of tests can we do in primary care to try and help move us forwards with this? Are there tests that we could do in primary care that might help?
Yeah, well, I think it depends, first of all, on what or where you're thinking this neuroendocrine tumour might be. And what stage you're thinking it might be. So are you thinking the patient maybe has a sort of disseminated malignancy or a localized one? And your tests will be focused on that. A lot of investigation pathways in the GI field now rely heavily on endoscopy. So, you know, you have dyspepsia, you referred for upper GI endoscopy. If you've got suspected colorectal cancer with anemia, change of bowel habit, weight loss, rectal bleeding, colonoscopy is the first test after a fit. But the problem with endoscopy is it doesn't pick up all neuroendocrine tumours. The commonest sites are places like the pancreas and the small bowel, and they're often not seen on these endoscopic investigation pathways. So the best test, and certainly the one that a GP can access in this situation, is a contrast-enhanced CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. That will show the majority of these lesions. And for those patients in whom this diagnosis has been missed for a long time, in my experience, that's usually how it comes to light. Somebody eventually decides to do a CT scan, whether it's for those symptoms or for something else. And then that shows the mesenteric mass or the liver metastases or whatever it shows. So the CT scan is actually a very good test for small bowel and pancreatic NETs. The question is who you should be doing it in. That's the whole challenge. You can't be doing a CT scan on all your patients with IBS, but it is probably the best test. People will probably remember from medical school various other blood tests and urine tests for this, but I wouldn't recommend that you do those. So I don't know if it's up here in Liverpool, but every medical student seems to remember about doing a 5-HIAA test on a 24-hour urine sample with an acidified bottle. It seems to be particularly well taught, but it is not good as a screening test. It's difficult to do. There's lots of false positives. you have to be on a restricted diet to get an accurate result, and it shouldn't be used as a test in this situation. It's, we do it, and it's useful in establishing the diagnosis where a patient's known to have a NET and for following them up and things like that. But as a screening test done in primary care in somebody with diarrhea, it probably has no utility. You can actually measure 5-HIAA now in serum rather than in urine, which is an easier test for patients than what we normally do. The other blood test is something called chromogranin A, which is useful, but again, there's lots of false positives, lots of false negatives. It's not useful as a screening test for, or by screening, I mean for as a sort of primary care test in somebody that you're thinking might have a NET. It is something that's done in secondary care, but I wouldn't encourage GP listeners to be doing those tests straight off. If you're going to do anything, I would suggest a CT scan.
Thanks, Mark. So this might sound like a silly question, but I always think there is no form of silly questions.
No, I agree.
If I'm a GP and I've done a scan and it's come back and it said that there is an incidental finding of a neuroendocrine, a likely possible neuroendocrine tumour, who do I refer to at that point? Who does it go to? Is it gastroenterologists or is it surgeons? Where do we go?
So ideally, you should try and find out where your local neuroendocrine tumour multidisciplinary team is. So there is one of those in most regions of the UK. So there are now several, I forget the exact number, I probably should have looked it up, what are called ENETS Centres of Excellence in the UK. So ENETS is the European Neuroendocrine Tumour Society, and they badge a number of centres as being able to provide comprehensive care for patients with neuroendocrine tumours. There are many throughout the UK. There's one in each of the devolved nations of the UK now, in Glasgow, Cardiff and Belfast, but there are many in England and throughout England as well. So in the Northwest, there's one in Liverpool, one in Manchester, there's one in Sheffield, Newcastle, Birmingham, and then three in London, Southampton, Oxford, all over the place. But as well as those, there are also neuroendocrine tumour multidisciplinary teams that are working in smaller centres who can manage much of the routine care for neuroendocrine tumours, but may not be able to deliver some of the very specialised stuff that they have to refer to one of these ENET centres for. So wherever you live in the UK, you probably will have a local NET multidisciplinary team. If as a GP you don't know how to access that, I think if you refer to an appropriate other specialist, whether that be oncologist or gastroenterologist or endocrinologist, they in secondary care will probably know who this is. But I think if you have a almost definite diagnosis, if the CT scan report says this looks like a neuroendocrine tumour, it's probably best to avoid delays in the pathway and find out where your local one is. There is a good organisation which I'm chair of called UKINETS, which is the UK and Ireland Neuroendocrine Tumour Society. We have a list of the centres on our website, and we'll perhaps come on to this later, but there's a very good charity in the UK supporting patients with neuroendocrine tumours called Neuroendocrine Cancer UK, and they too have very good information on their website with addresses of the various NET centres. So by doing a bit of Googling, you can probably find where your local one is and then refer along to them.
Thanks a lot, Mark. That does bring on to the part of the podcast where I just wanted to ask about how we would support a patient in primary care who's been diagnosed with a NET. And you've touched there on Neuroendocrine Cancer UK and UKINETS. Could you just talk a bit more about how we can help support the care of a patient with a neuroendocrine tumour who's been diagnosed?
Yeah. So I think it's important that they are referred to a NET multidisciplinary team, because I think more than, I don't want to make the claim of more than any other type of cancer, but certainly as much as any cancer, this needs a multidisciplinary approach. There are lots of different types of treatment that these patients may need, ranging from surgery to interventional radiology to nuclear medicine treatments to endocrine treatments to endoscopic treatments to oncology treatments with chemotherapy and things in some cases. So they need to have an access to a team who's able to deliver all those options. And the various NET MDTs throughout the country have that. Those teams are now all supported by specialist nurses too. And they're crucial for the care of these patients and coordinating that care, because they may well see various different specialists within that team. And usually, certainly in our case, the specialist nurses coordinate a lot of that. So I think referring them on to a NET multidisciplinary team rather than the patient being managed by an isolated gastroenterologist or something who's not part of such a team is important. And I think as a GP, I would encourage you to make sure that your patient has access to that full breadth of expertise rather than just seeing one individual who may only be able to deliver part of the required options. Neuroendocrine Cancer UK, you also mentioned, and yeah, this is a fantastic charity, provides great support for patients with neuroendocrine tumours. The first thing I tell all the patients and new patients is the website address of Neuroendocrine Cancer UK, because in the past we used to give people, you know, patient information leaflets and things like that, but we don't need to do so anymore because all the information is on their website. So they've got what were the traditional patient information leaflets, which you can print out if you want, but the information is there. It's high quality information which is relevant to UK patients. That organization also has lots of other support groups. So there are local support groups for patients with neuroendocrine tumours. They're often called NATA groups. Neuroendocrine Cancer UK can provide telephone support for patients. If they ring up, they can either put them in touch with local groups, or I think there are Facebook groups and things like that that patients can join. And they're often, many patients find them very supportive. It's not for everybody, but lots of patients do use them and find them very helpful.
Brilliant, really helpful there. Thank you so much. We're coming to the end, Mark. This is your opportunity to impart any kind of key messages for our audience. So do you have any key take-homes you'd like to share with the audience today?
Maybe learn a little bit more about neuroendocrine tumours, because you will come across them. Now that they are as prevalent as they are, I think as a GP, you should know a little bit. I don't expect GPs to know everything about everything, but I think it was worth knowing a little bit about how these tumours present and are treated. And also, if you suspect them, what to do. If you don't feel comfortable organising a CT scan or whatever, refer those patients along that you're a bit worried about. So, you know, we've all seen, you know, your 25-year-old new patient with irritable bowel syndrome, classical symptoms, you're probably not that worried about that individual. But your 50-year-old who's never had symptoms before and has lost a bit of weight, probably not the one to be sitting on for a long time. Think about referring those on. If you feel comfortable, maybe get a CT scan. If not, refer them along to a gastroenterologist probably for assessment.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Mark. Really, really clear. Loads and loads of useful points within that podcast. So thanks so much for joining me and giving your time today. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you very much for having me.
So that was an episode packed with information, really useful advice from Mark there. So lots and lots of information to take on board. And I hope that you've come away with a greater understanding and appreciation of this form of cancer. And hopefully, you know, we don't need to know everything about neuroendocrine tumours, as Mark has said, but we just do need to be aware of it. We need to understand how it can present. We need to be aware of how to refer on and how to support these patients. My top take-home messages. So number one, that neuroendocrine tumours are the 10th most prevalent cancer in England, with a rising incidence. So these are things that we will see in primary care at some point, either at diagnosis or managing and supporting these patients who have been diagnosed previously. Number two, these can mimic other conditions such as irritable bowel syndrome. We should be wary of the older patient with new IBS symptoms or those with other red flags such as weight loss or simply those not responding to IBS therapies. And number three, don't worry about using urine or blood tests specifically to diagnose neuroendocrine tumours. Just organise a CT scan, a contrast CT, or refer on to the secondary care teams. And as Mark said, you know, that could be the gastroenterologist, it could be endocrinology, it could be oncology. If you're suspicious, refer on and get those tests done, because we know that earlier diagnosis leads to better outcomes. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode. I very much hope that you found it useful and interesting. If you have enjoyed this episode, please click follow and then we'll update you whenever we bring out a new episode. Please share it with your colleagues. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.